Hello there, listeners, ladies, gentlemen, and everything in between. Welcome to Keyframe on the Geek Show Podcast Network. I'm Tucky, and today I'm joined by Rob for more animation goodness.
Hello.
All right.
Yes, and nobody else again.
It's almost like they're dead.
We haven't killed them, Tucky. I have to keep listen, it's called an alibi, okay? It's called plausible deniability. You have to remember those terms.
Yeah, well, they're not dead, just to clarify. We have not murdered.
No.
But in this day and age, you never know. Psychopaths are everywhere.
Yes.
And psychopaths.
That was the worst dad joke.
I'm allowed at least one.
I think you've used up your year's quota, haven't you, with that one joke?
I can't say it's worth it.
It wasn't worth it at all.
Oh, right. So I believe you've got something to review.
Yes, I do. I mean, as we've pointed out before, we are, there's not much that ever happens in the news. It's many people doing the jobs, so we're just going to get straight into this. And I'm going to kick things off with, let's see, which one should I choose? Choose one or two.
Go for two.
Okay, so you chose Matoi the Sacred Slayer, also known in Japanese as Soshin Shoujo Matoi, who in the anime is more commonly known by the nickname Toi-chan. Let's start at the beginning. Matoi the Sacred Slayer is a magical girl anime. It came out in 2016, October 2016 to December 2016, and it's basically an original animation, right? It's not based on a manga or a light novel or anything like that.
This is just straight from animation. There's no other reference material.
It was produced by White Fox, who've done some pretty interesting work in the last few years. They're the ones who did the Jomungan series, which I quite like. They did Otoware Romano, The False Faces. They did Is the Order a Rabbit? ReZero, they did as well.
All right.
Grimoire of Zero, Steins Gate Zero, lots of Zeros. They're also working on Goblin Slayer, which I'm really looking forward to. So, and they're also working on Arufureta, which I'm also looking forward to as well. I know Arufureta is basically like the ultimate otaku fan fiction. But this is the thing. It is. It purely is. But it's quite dark, the story, and I like the darkness that's in the story more than I actually like the story. But anyway, we're not talking about Goblin Slayer, which, by the way, if you're not reading the manga of Goblin Slayer or the light novel of Goblin Slayer, what are you waiting for?
You're on a time limit, listeners.
Well, they are, literally, because the anime adaptation is out.
Oh, hi, it's new season.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got limited time to get to know just how good Goblin Slayer actually is, and it's, pardon my phrasing, but it's pretty f***ing good. Anyway, back to Matoi the Sacred Slayer. This is the story of Matoi Tsuburagi, who is, ostensibly, she's a middle school, high school shrine maiden, and she is at the Tenman Shrine with her friend Yuma Kusanagi, who is also a shrine maiden there, and they're basically shrine maidens in training kind of thing. And all Matoi wants is a normal life. Her mother disappeared 10 years previously, and her father, Shingo, is a police detective who she calls Shingo instead of father, which is a bit of an oddity, and it does explain why she does that much later on in the anime. I think it's in the final episode, in fact, that it does that. But this is the thing. Matoi the Sacred Slayer, it's actually an interesting idea more than anything else. It's an interesting take on the whole magical girl type thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
The way it justifies the whole magical girl thing is that they're not truly magical girls. They're more like priestesses. And this is where it gets a bit weird. It does the whole, it does have fan service in this. But the fan service is kind of that non-sexual fan service. It's there more for comedy than it is for anything else, right?
So the usual clumsy tropes kind of thing.
It's not the usual clumsy tropes. It's not someone falls over into someone's crotch or anything like that. the thing about Matoy the Sacred Slayer is there are these things that are coming through to our world, and there are people who fight against those things. Now, these things are coming through from some other place, and it does go into more detail about what that other place or those other places are. And the people who fight against them, there are different organizations depending on which part of the world you live in. Now, from Europe, you have a secret organization that's been working for the Vatican for years. In Asia, you have their own version of that. In America, you have a different version of it. And they're all basically doing the same thing. They're all fighting against these creatures that are invading our world. And these creatures are coming into our world to basically take the world's power, take certain abilities from the world, certain powers from the world. And Matoy is pulled into the middle of this, and she doesn't know why. She doesn't know what's going on. She has no idea about any of this because she's just a normal girl and she just wants an ordinary life, an ordinary, peaceful, boring life. This is where the story gets a little bit interesting. Right at the beginning, you see a different character. You see a girl called Clarice Tonatolos. I think that's how you pronounce her name. She dresses in kind of a saber type outfit, you know, saber from Fate Stay Night, kind of a dark saber outfit, and she fights with a sword and then with pistols and stuff like that. And she fights against this being who disappears through a hole in reality or in space or whatever. And she knows this whatever it is, and she's sworn revenge on this whatever it is, this monstrous type thing. And that's all you know at the beginning. But by the second episode, you find out that another monster, a totally different monster, attacks the temple where Matoy and Yuma are. Now, they're out. They arrive there. And Yuma has this thing. She wants to be a magical girl. She desperately wants to be a magical girl, even though she's 13 years old and is supposed to start growing out of the whole idea of being a magical girl.
And do they know that magical girls are real at this time, or is it
No. It's just basically a fantasy at that point. And Yuma thinks that because historically, her ancestors who ran the shrine, they used to be exorcists and they used to exorcise demons, and she thinks that's the closest thing to her being a magical girl. So she calls exorcisms exing and stuff like that. So let's go exing, you know, that sort of thing. And yeah, I know it doesn't sound dodgy at all, does it?
It's one of them things where it's like, your kid's talking about exing.
Yeah.
You should be worried.
Exactly. And that's when she first said it, I was like, that doesn't sound dodgy at all. Not in the slightest. So anyway, when a monster attacks Ten Man Shrine, Yuma, thinking that it's an opportunity for her to become a magical girl, does this ritual for her to become a magical girl. Unfortunately, Matoy sees the danger to Yuma, who's right in this monster's path, and runs out to try and save her, unconsciously doing exactly the same action that Yuma's doing that's based on the scroll that Yuma's holding. And that was a nice little play on posture that I actually found quite interesting, because the actual stance that Yuma is supposed to adopt is one of those reaching out stances, and Matoy, right, in her desperation to save her friend, is reaching out to save her friend.
Yeah. Do you see what I mean? So it's kind of accidentally on purpose.
Kind of accidentally on purpose. And Matoy becomes the magical girl, or the magical shrine maiden in this case. What she doesn't know is that there's history there, and that comes clear later on in the series. The interesting thing, though, is what has actually happened, and this is where it deviates from the usual magical girl format. The usual magical girl format is, oh, you've been given these powers, you now have these powers, you have this thing that allows you to become a magical girl, blah, blah, blah. Whereas in this, it's actually gods.
All right.
And this is where I found it interesting. See, what they're actually saying in this is that these girls are actually clothing themselves in their god. So they're basically wearing their god and wielding their god as a sword and shield, as a suit of armor, that sort of thing. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's where it got interesting for me, because when they said that, I thought, that's a really smart idea. There's a lot you could do with that, especially with Japan having myriad gods, and they actually do actually refer to Matoy eventually as wielding the myriad gods.
Yeah. Also, noticing there, Yuma's second name, Kusanagi.
Yeah.
The legendary sword of the wind.
Yeah. I mean, Yuma eventually you know, I'm not spoiling anything here because it's kind of in the intro anyway. Yume eventually becomes a magical girl herself. And you know Matoy is a magical girl because her name is in the title. and even the poster art shows that Yume becomes a magical girl, so it's fine, right? But this is the thing. The actual story is a bit more complex than I thought it was going to be. I thought this was going to be one of those Pretty Cure-esque, Sailor Moon-esque storylines where there's a little bit of romance thrown in there and everything like that. But this was
just kind of juggling real life with the second life.
Yeah, but this was surprisingly grounded, right? It was surprisingly grounded. It did away with the usual, the lead female character is vapidly in love with some hot guy from somewhere. It basically said, no, we're not going to bother with that. All she wants is a normal life. She wishes her mother was back in their lives and was at home with the dad, and they had basically the family unit together, and they could have breakfast together on a morning like a normal family. That's all she wants. And so in Matoy's mind, maybe eventually she'll find a boyfriend, but she's just not interested at the moment. Yuma is 13 years old and totally not interested in men. She's, you know, totally wanting to be a magical girl. That's where her love is, right? Magical girl.
It's good that they're actually taking that approach, because usually like 13 or 14 year olds are like, oh, I'm madly in love, I want a boyfriend. And it's like, no, oh, you're too young for it. Stop.
Yeah. What I like is they shifted the goalposts with regards to the romance. Shingo works as a police detective. And you think with his wife not being there, he'd be the love interest one, but he's basically devoted to his wife. The story is basically him and his wife met and it was love at first sight. They got married. He had a daughter. But then his wife disappeared. He actually knows what's happened, right? But he has never told his daughter. But I'm not going to go into that because that's a bit of a spoiler there.
Yeah, so. I'm guessing it's like, oh, well, it's information which divulged earlier could have caused a lot of, could have saved a lot of hassle later on.
I'm not going to say anything because it is a spoiler.
All right.
I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying whether you're right or you're wrong. It could be both. It could be neither. I don't know. Okay. Plausible deniability. It's coming back to haunt us. What I will say, though, is the actual structure of the world that they've created, the actual universe, multiverse, whatever you want to call it, that they've created for this simple 12 episodes, I'm surprised at how much thought they've put into it. Now, it's a credit to the director, Masayuki Sakoi, that he's managed to keep this flowing. To a degree, because it's easy for it to become deviated, it's easy for it to fall into the same trap that all the other magical girl shows fall into, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy for it to basically be a trope-filled magical girl series, and there are some of the usual magical girl tropes in there. It doesn't play on the whole naked transformation thing, I hate that, but it does the opposite. Because you know when they transform?
Yeah, the mysterious glowing clothing out of nowhere.
Well, not just that. What happens to their clothes? And this plays on that, and that's where the fan service comes in, because this parodies the whole idea of the naked transformation, because when they transform from their magical girl form, their clothes have basically been destroyed. So they're naked.
All right.
And what happens to Matoy on a couple of occasions is that she'll basically beat the monster and then she'll be relaxed, so she'll power down, effectively, because she's just relieved at beating the monster, not thinking there may be cameras on her, there may be people around, or something like that.
Yeah.
And then she's like, oh no, then she's running away, like really embarrassed and trying to cover her nakedness, that sort of thing. So it's done more for comedy purposes in this than it is in some other shows I could name. I'm not going to name them, though.
Flippers.
Yeah, I wasn't going to name. In terms of the production, the voice acting's pretty good in this overall. The dialogue's quite interesting. There are some very interesting characters. And like I said, when it comes to the romance, they shift the goalposts a little bit. Shingo has a guy working for him whose nickname is Pochi because he's basically like a dog. And initially they make that joke to make it sound as though he basically fetches and carries for them. But it's actually more than you think it is, because he doesn't have a girlfriend and he's basically horny as hell. So keeps trying it on with every single attractive woman he meets. All of them turn him down, but calling him Pochi.
Yeah.
does work in that context, you know? It's that old Armageddon joke. I don't know if you know it. You know the one for Steve Buscemi, where they call him Rockhound?
Yeah. You know? Oh, no.
Have you not? Do you not remember from Armageddon?
When I remember Armageddon, but I only remember Ben Affleck and Bruce Willis threatening to kill Ben Affleck.
Yeah. Now, in Armageddon, they've got this joke about Steve Buscemi. He's like, what about Rockhound? And he's like, who's Rockhound? He's a brilliant geologist. We call him Rockhound because, well, he's horny. And that's basically Pochi. He's not a geologist. He is a detective. So they call him Pochi.
So if, now when I watch this, I'm going to think Steve Buscemi.
You might just do that. So they've got some interesting characters in this. Not too many, right? Not too many, I have to specify. One of the funniest characters is the old grandma who eventually appears because she knows far more than she's letting on. And that's when you start getting an idea of just how complex the world building truly is. But for me, they introduced it a little bit too late. It would have been nicer if they'd introduced it a lot earlier because it's only 12 episodes, because that would have fleshed things out a lot more. What they actually introduce is the idea that we live in one dimension and our world actually has 24 dimensions.
All right, right? So it's not your usual, this is heaven, this is hell, purgatory might appear later when we run out of material kind of thing.
No. And the other thing as well is that the way that Clarice dons her regalia, that's the formal term that they give to being clothed in your god, they call it donning your regalia. Or wearing your regalia, whatever it is. But they call it regalia. And the way that Clarice uses hers is different to the way that Matoy uses hers.
Mm.
And so you have this difference in approach from one continent to another. And from one belief system to another. Which is interesting as well. It's these little details that actually make this more interesting to watch than your usual magical girl fare. Ultimately, though, the story is Fruit Loops. Right. It quite literally is. The production, it does go for some reality bending and some mind twisting and stuff like that. It does play around with the visual style a lot. And that's one of the things I think is a massive plus point for this. There are some scenes where it looks like it was animated by Studio Trigger when they were doing Kill la Kill. And I can understand why they've done that. And it is an effective style when it's used correctly. And in most cases in Matoy the Sacred Slayer, they do use it correctly. The music is, well, it's neither here nor there. They've got some decent atmospheric tracks, but for the most part, it's forgettable. Voice acting, as I said, is pretty decent. Dialogue's pretty decent. There's some interesting banter. Matoy tends to say the same things over and over again. There's no English dub for this. It's in Japanese with subtitles. And it's, if I remember rightly, it is actually available now, so you can get this. I know this has been given 6.76 on MAL, right?
Yeah.
But I've got to be honest, I think it's a flat and solid 7. I think that it's a decent enough show that if you're a fan of Magical Girl anime and you want to see something that's a slightly different take on it with a bit more reality bending, and a bit less of the naked transformations, then this is what you want. It's not bad. It's not a bad attempt at a magical girl anime from White Fox and Masayuki Sakoi.
So it's over here on MVM?
I think it's MVM, yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds interesting, especially after the hell that was Flip Flappers.
This is the thing. They've got like two extra episodes on. It's on three DVDs, and it's got two extra episodes. There's a special program, which is like a recap episode.
Yeah.
And then there's an OVA, which is called Nightbusters Incorporated. And the OVA is actually quite an interesting one because Matoy wakes up one day and her mum and her dad are being all lovey-dovey because they haven't seen each other in 10 years. And so they've got a lot of catching up to do. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more. And what they do in the Nightbusters Incorporated, because the things that come through from the other dimensions, they call them knights, N-I-G-H-T, right?
Right.
And there are a couple of bits in this that I found really funny. The organization for the Vatican is called Anti-Creed. And when I first saw that name, I thought that they were talking about the quasi-rock band from America.
Oh, place your hands.
Yeah, I thought they were talking about them. I thought, that's not a nice thing. They only did one good song. There's no reason to hate them.
The thing was, they were Christian rock as well.
That I found quite ironic was that they actually called them Antichrist.
I'm just thinking now that they've buggered up at the Pope's birthday party. They've just been excommunicated.
So anyway, Nightbusters Incorporated is basically Yuma, Matthew's friend, who is also a magical girl now, after the final episode. This is actually after the final episode. Sorry, I should have said spoiler alert with Matthew's mum and Matthew's dad.
I think we know it was heading that way. Cause, yeah. You know, why have her?
Yeah. So this does contain a couple of spoilers. Not much. So anyway, Yuma has decided to set up a business because there are still knights around and, small pockets of knights, and they need to be taken care of. And so Mato and Yuma are basically the only people in Japan who can sort that out. So Yuma sets up a business, and a bunch of the characters who they meet throughout the series, they basically jump on board with the business because it fits with what their governments and their organizations actually want, so they're willing to help the business as it is. And
tell us that Winston Zeddemore joins up.
See, you saw where this is going then. Yeah, with being called Nightbusters Incorporated. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's basically where it is. They've got like a little hearse type vehicle.
Oh, yes.
And right next to Matthew's house, Yuma has what's basically the Ghostbusters fire station. Built right next to Matoy's house. So Matoy comes out one morning, and the best bit about this episode, though, is they go for the Bobby Ewing ending and then play it up by saying, nah. You know the Bobby Ewing ending that I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
Right. Do you remember Dallas?
Yeah. Who shot you off?
Yeah. Well, do you remember the shower scene?
This was parodied by Family Guy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was all a dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. They basically do the entire Nightbusters Incorporated episode, and then Matthew wakes up and goes, oh, I had this weird dream.
Aww.
Oh, no, it gets better, because she walks out the front door only to see the fire station next to her house. She didn't have a dream. Basically, what she had was more of a prophecy.
So it's going to happen.
Basically, he's like, no, I just want a normal life. Leave me alone. So anyway, Matthew the Sacred Slayer, pretty decent show. I was surprised that I enjoyed it as much as I did. It had some rare flashes of ingenuity that I like to see in magic. You know, it was trying to do something different. By introducing the different dimensions, it was trying to explain things a lot more than usual, than you usually get in magical girl anime.
It sounds really interesting.
Well, like, as soon as it started using dimensions, I automatically developed a soft spot for it because it started reminding me a bit more of Nanoha. And you know how much I love Nanoha.
You do love Nanoha.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at the poster here, and it's got one of the Sacred Jewels on as well.
Oh, yeah. Also, this is actually in the same universe. Matthew the Sacred Slayer is actually in the same universe as Supersonico.
All right.
Yeah.
Ah.
People don't realize that it's actually in the same universe as Supersonico because she actually makes a cameo in that OVA.
Well, there you go. So there'll be some familiarity there for
It's a tiny, tiny non-speaking cameo.
Sorry, a lot of the Sonico fans like it when she's non-speaking, sitting on the desk judging them.
Anyway.
You know who you are.
Yes, you do know who you are. Moving on to you, Chucky, and this time you're taking the magic away, aren't you?
Yeah, well, speaking of side universes and cameos and all that...
Well, we're not speaking about cameos because we don't have the jockstraps.
Well, we've... you threw us off now. I'm back on Netflix. I'm addicted to Netflix. It's like me streaming crack at the moment. Not streaming crack, that sounds wrong. It's there, and it's doing all right stuff with animation, and just a few mentions. One, live action Bleach is coming over, to Netflix soon, just like we predicted it would.
Yeah.
I think every live action anime is going to be picked up by Netflix now. They're just hoovering up all live action. And also Death Note 2, Electric Boogaloo, or Shinigami Boogaloo. it's getting made, and people can't believe it's getting made. Basically, everybody was like, oh, live action Death Note, it's going to be horrible, but they still watched it. See, and basically, the creators went, well, look at all these people who watched it.
See, I want them to do Bleach X Death Note, right? Where Light picks up what he thinks is the Death Note, but it's not. It's actually one of Ichigo's workbooks from school, because he's still a high school student. And so Light completes the workbook, and then Ichigo turns up going, oh, right, you finished all my homework. Thank you.
The end.
Yes.
somehow Rukia is like related to Ryuk, because they are both Shinigami.
Well, they're all Shinigami, and that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so
can you imagine if Ryuk is basically, he's not a Shinigami, he's basically like a gangster from the seedier part of town who thinks he's a Shinigami.
He's just some low-level nobody.
Yes. And the Death Note, the whole thing with the Death Note is basically, yes, it kills people, but it's kind of, he's got to complete this in order to try and take the Shinigami exam, and so he's cheating. But Light doesn't know this, and so Light is doing all his stuff, but he's actually being judged as unworthy by Soul Society.
See, there you go, Netflix, and whoever's making these live-action anime adaptations. I can't see where they're going with it, because the thing is, the live-action wasn't as bad as people say, but everybody watched it and said it was bad. But the thing is, they watched it, so them figures pushed it further as like, well, look, all of these people watched it. Doesn't matter if they loved it or hated it. You know, it's like if they brought the Emoji Movie over to Netflix, you know for a fact over half the viewership's going to watch it. An Emoji Movie's going to turn around to Netflix and go, well, look at the figures we have. Imagine if we did a mini-series of Emoji.
Yeah, but I never understood this. If you think something is going to be bad, don't watch it. I'm going to use an analogy here. I'm going to use a religious analogy here. You can tell I've just been talking about a show that has gods in it. Did you know that people who call themselves atheists aren't actually atheists?
Go on then, how?
Anyone who calls themselves an atheist and then after that says, I don't believe in God, is not an actual atheist, because in order to not believe in God, you first have to believe in God.
Yeah, it's the catch 22, isn't it?
Yeah, in order to deny the existence of something, you have to believe that they exist in the first place. You can't get out of that. It's a paradoxical argument that you just cannot escape. The true atheist is the one who goes, God exists, God doesn't exist, I don't care.
Yeah. I've got a life to lead rather than going on about fictional characters.
Yeah. I just don't care. Don't bother me. Leave me alone. That's an atheist. An atheist doesn't actually give two hoots. And so if you don't want them to make more Death Note movies, don't give two hoots about the Death Note movie.
Don't even watch it out of curiosity, because curiosity is the thing that'll kill you. That's what they say about cats, and it's true about humans
too.
Yeah,
but they have that whole addendum. Satisfaction brought it back. No, it didn't. Satisfaction never brought anybody back, right? If a guy dies with a stiffy and you whack him off, doesn't bring him back.
Jesus Christ, bro. Keep it in. Are you made an hour to revive the dead?
No.
I want those necromancers.
I bet.
The necro is short for necrophilia. Yeah, angel lust and all that.
I knew that'd get you.
Oh, I think you broke us, man.
You're going to keep that joke, aren't you?
Benny Benassi's song's so wrong now.
Anyway.
Yeah, so moving on. Netflix, let's say they're doing things with animation. As I've said, live-action anime is now making itself well at home there. And another thing that's just made itself well at home is Matt Groening, or groaning or groaning.
I like just to call him Matt Gurning, because I just imagine that he's just busy pulling faces at Fox executives whenever they ask him, so what's this show about?
Sticks a toilet seat over his head, pulls a face, wins a trophy. No, we are British. That's a legitimate thing to do.
Yeah, I know. But this is the thing. I just imagine he's basically got so much power now and so much influence that whenever the Fox executives say, so what's this show about, Matt? He just stands there and pulls weird faces at them.
And then they actually like respond as if it's like a legitimate conversation.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, we can't do that many episodes. Can we cut it down to about 18 a season? He just pulls another face and like, okay, Matt. But he's dipping his toe into the whole making cartoon things, because The Simpsons is, as we've stated before, it's a zombie at the moment.
Hang on, what do you mean he's dipping his toe into making the whole cartoon thing?
Well, no, because the thing is, his route used to be, I'll go to the Fox executives and I'll try to wow them. And, you know, major TV, he managed for The Simpsons, he's managed for Futurama. But now Netflix is here. Netflix, the biggest like streaming platform in the world at the moment, I believe it is.
Yeah, but on Netflix, he's going to have a lot more freedom, isn't he?
Well, that's the thing. He's got no like, oh, you've got to make it like, you know, don't diss Trump or anything like, you know, the kind of things, the background political things like, oh, that joke's a bit risky. Our sponsors won't like that. With Netflix, it's a case of he's walked in, he's went, hey, I made The Simpsons. And they're like, how much do you want and when do you want it?
You know, if you just stand over there, we'll get our money cannon.
That's we'll stand in this chamber, we'll make it rain.
Much. Just stand over here. We're just going to cover you in tar, and then we're going to fire money at you. However much sticks is however much you get.
And that's how he's got disenchantment.
Is it disenchantment or disenchanted?
No, disenchantment. It's... how best to describe it? It's one of those shows which it's exactly like Futurama, but it's not Futurama.
It's basically the fantasy version of Futurama, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like Game of Thrones-arama kind of thing. It's that kind of thing.
Thrones-arama. I like that.
Game of Thrones, you've got like the intrigue of like all these things going on, like, ooh, it's a fantasy setting. And basically, all Matt's done is he's watched Game of Thrones and went, you know what, I want a piece of that cake.
See,
and this is his piece of Thrones cake, yeah. I believe.
Thrones cake. Sounds totally wrong, okay? If you want Thrones cake, just, you know, I always flush my Thrones cakes away. but anyway, you called it Game of Thrones-arama, and that just sounds like a quiz show.
Well,
it sounds like some kind of primetime game show. Welcome to Game of Thrones-arama. So, which of these characters is going to die this week?
It might as well be. And I've watched this. I've sat and I've marathoned it because I am a scumbag with no life. And it's one of those shows where it's hyped up. It's like you say, it's like he made The Simpsons. So, you know, this is, and it always gets hyped up to like, well, this is going to be better than Simpsons, better than Futurama kind of thing. And obviously that's part of the parcel of the whole, like, you know, advertising campaigns, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've got to ask though, can anything actually be better than Futurama? Because in my opinion, Futurama was basically the best sci-fi comedy that I can name.
Better than Red Dwarf?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, especially after that whole, they did the one episode where the laughing track and I was like, oh, this is weird. Yeah, so this is I wouldn't say that this is better than Futurama, but there's a lot of Futurama in it. You can hear the voices. Like, there's a very similar cast. There's also that guy from Garth Marenghi's Dark Place and the IT Crowd. You know, with the one with the dramatic British accent.
Oh, yes, I know who you're on about. He played the role of Toast in Toast of London as well, Matt Berry.
Yeah, his voice is very distinctive, and his characters are also like very comedic as well. Because in this one, he's kind of like the prince. It was in one of the teasers that Princess Bean, who's like the main protagonist, is forced to be married, and her husband to be gets impaled on the throne of swords.
Yeah,
and he's somehow still alive, but it's like And they're like, oh, we need to save this alliance. It's like, so he just stands up from the wedding congregation. He's like, she probably would have left him for me anyway. It's like there's little comedic bits that I appreciate. And obviously in the first episode, you need to be hooked. But the rest of it turns out, like, say, Bean's this uncultured princess. Her mother's, I wouldn't say went missing, but her mother was turned to stone when she was very young. You find out later as to the whole thing surrounding that. Which is this alcoholic character who's been brought up by a bunch of blokes in a pub, really. Not a father, because her father's, he's went on, he's remarried to, I think she's some kind of like sea serpent swamp monster. And he's had a son to her, so obviously the prince is next in line, so she's like an afterthought at the moment. But she's this problem child that he always has to, the only use she has at the time is, like, you know, marry her off for I think it was for an agreement on a canal or something daft like that. But that's a side note to the whole thing. It's basically her adventure with these two other characters. One is a demon that's cursed to her, because there's some kind of like behind the scenes skullduggery. The thing is, they introduce this demon in a box at the wedding. It's like the box goes in front of her. She opens it. And he's like, "Ha, you're cursed now. I'm your demon forever." And then this demon all of a sudden is like, "I'll make your life hell." And she's like, "Oh, well, you know, give it your best shot, because it's already pretty dire." And the third character in this is L4. And they do a lot of jokes with that. It's basically like, "Oh, you can't stay here." And he wants a different life to the happy life that the elves lead in this magical, like, sort of like hidden away tree place. The chocolates and kisses, because the elves have a diet of chocolate, apparently. And he wants to go out and experience the world and experience like proper emotions like depression and sadness, which is kind of weird. And they're like, "Oh, you can't go out. Once you leave, you can't return, not even return or came back." Because all the elves have an O on the end, and it's a little pun thing. But he's the third member of the party, and they do this whole will they, won't they, which the kind of jokingly like reference as well later on. But Disenchantment, it's one of them series, like I say, it's hyped, but it's not as good as the hype would suggest it. The animation's obviously like usual, what you'd expect from The Simpsons, Futurama. Like I say, the voice cast, there are a few good additions to it, but the rest are kind of like old and familiar, like voices, like I say, mostly from Futurama. Characters that don't develop that well. Like I say, the main protagonist, Bean, she's like a drunk, like rebellious teenager, and she's always that throughout the whole thing. She doesn't really gain empathy until like the last part of it. And all the other characters are just plain as well. Like I say, it's one of the things, I mean, I think it got 57% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
Which isn't, it's not that, like I say, it isn't that good. And they try to play on the whole like king versus princess kind of thing, like daddy, daughter. And it just doesn't work. There's a side story, like I say, with the demon. There's the other side story with the elf. And at times it feels like they could have benefited from doing a format, you know, like how American Dad and Family Guy do, where they split all the characters off into two groups and focus on them. And then it all comes to like a head at the end of it. But they don't really do that. They try and keep them all together, and it's all just one massive jumble. Like, see, I don't want to spoil it, because this is something you will like to marathon, especially if you're like me, but it won't grab your attention. It'll just be one of them things that, yeah, it's on. Yeah, I've watched it. Yeah, I can talk about it to all my other friends who... So some people think it's amazing. Other people are just like, meh. And I think the crowd of meh is bigger than the, well, it's amazing crowd this time round. But Matt's got his money. He's got something on Netflix. There's no memes of it.
Wow.
So it hasn't hit proper popularity until you see the memes, and there have been absolutely no memes so far. Yeah, but that's it. I wouldn't recommend it, but obviously it's that hyped, people will watch.
Wow.
I don't know if you want to give it a go, Rob, if you've got that kind of time to waste.
I don't, unfortunately. I have Shenmue 1 and 2 to play.
Ah, yes, I heard that's been re-released for PS4, hasn't it?
Yes.
That's on Press X, isn't it?
That'll be on the on YouTube. Anyway,
plug it.
So anyway, Press X is also available on our network because it is video game discussions. Some pretty interesting ones as well we've done. But anyway, we're not talking about Press X. We are talking about something completely different. Now, years ago, years and years and years and years, you know, 47 years ago. Well, not that long. Back in 1983.
2 years before I was born.
Back in 1983, an author in Japan called Hideyuki Kikuchi created a series of novels, and he had illustrations by the then relatively unknown Yoshitaka Amano. And what he created was a series of 26 novels, some of them consisting of as many as 4 volumes. What he created was a series called Vampire Hunter D.
Ah, the classics.
Now, the concept of Vampire Hunter D was so good that 2 years after it was made, it became an animated movie in 1985, which was released in the UK in the early 90s. I think it was 91 or 92, something like that.
Yeah, it was one of those when anime was just coming over before the 1994, like Jonathan Ross thing. This was one of them, the anime movies which gave the public the impression like, well, it's all horror, gore, and, you know, beasts.
The thing is, Vampire Hunter D wasn't all horror, gore, and beasts. There was a style to it, a substance to it, that you just didn't actually get from pretty much anything. And the original Vampire Hunter D, see, I remember when this came out, I bought it straight away. If I remember rightly, it was Manga Entertainment who released it.
Yeah.
And I had it on video cassette, and I watched it and watched it and watched it and watched it, and I loved it so much that when the game came out on the PS1, I bought the game. The original Vampire Hunter D was a story about an infamous half-vampire, half-human vampire hunter. Now, that type of creature, that type of person is also known as a Dunpeel in these stories. He goes only by the letter D. That's all people know him as, which is where the name Vampire Hunter D comes from. Now, these stories are set in the far future of Earth. Vampires have dominated the world. They basically control the world in the original movie. They do pretty much what they want because vampires are free. You are a vampire. Spin on, then, 15 years. And 15 years after the original release of Vampire Hunter, you had a new Vampire Hunter D called Bloodlust. And artistically, stylistically, it takes the same approach as the original Vampire Hunter D, but with more attention to the artwork by Yoshitaka Amano, more attention to the character design so that they match the artwork of Yoshitaka Amano. So it has a very distinctive character style. And Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust is, it adopts kind of a little bit of the Old West ethos, you know, the stranger rides into town to basically save the girl, blah, 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 blah. Now, this movie has been out since 2000, and I know that loads of people have seen it, and it's out again on Blu-ray, and it is just as stylish, just as brutal, just as violent, just as tragic as it originally was in 2000.
So it's held up.
Yes, it's held up far better than I think anybody actually expected. And a lot of the reason for that is because they did such a damn good job on the movie originally, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so now when you watch it on Blu-ray, it really looks good. Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust, again, is about D, the infamous Dunpeel vampire hunter. And this time he's been called upon to locate a young lady called Charlotte Elborn, who has apparently been kidnapped. She's the daughter of an affluent family, and he's getting paid $20 million to find her dead or alive, which doesn't make her brother happy, but her dad understands if she's been turned into a vampire, he wants her dead.
Yeah.
Now, in addition to Dee, they've also thrown the job out to a group of bounty hunters. Now, at this point in time, it's not clear whether this is after the original Vampire Hunter D movie or before. I think it's set after because vampires are dwindling and now they're being hunted to extinction. but they still have a lot of power. They still have a lot of control. They still have a lot of influence because they are basically immortal. So what you have then is basically a long chase, a long and drawn out chase scene, which lasts for a lot of the movie as Dee chases the horse-drawn carriage, which has this young lady and basically the vampire who took this young lady, right? Now, The vampire who took the young lady is called Meyer Link. He's a baron and he is very, very powerful. Now, he is trying to escape. He is trying to get to the castle of Carmilla so that he can basically take Charlotte away from all of this stuff. And over the course of the story, you realize that there's more going on than just a straight up kidnapping. It's not as simple as that. It's not that Maya has basically gone and kidnapped Charlotte and taken her away. There's a whole lot more going on, and that's where the tragedy comes into this. You also find out a bit more about Dee, about his heritage, and his heritage was vocalized at the end of the first movie. And again, they touch on it here as well. How can he be so powerful? Where does he get so much power from? You know who he is. Everybody knows who Dee actually is. But there's just something cool about this movie. There's something stylish about this movie that once you sit down and you start watching it, you will watch the whole thing. This is a bit like Die Hard. There's very few things in anime that I would class in the same category as Die Hard, where you start watching it and you basically finish watching it in one sitting and you don't stop and you don't skip. Yeah. That's the important thing, I think, is that you don't stop and you don't skip. You don't basically move on through the episode. You basically have the entire movie playing for the entire movie. There's very few movies that can actually make me, as cynical as I am and as jaded as I am, do that. Vampire Hunter D: Bloodlust is one of them.
So this is the movie and not a series?
No, this is a movie. If I remember rightly, I don't think it's had a series. I think it's just been movies. It's had like audio stuff and various things like that, but this is just the movies.
Yeah.
The thing about Vampire Hunter D: Bloodlust is that the production side of things, it looks great. The audio is amazing. There's only the English dub on the Blu-ray, yeah?
Yeah.
But that's not a bad thing, right? Because this is one of those English dubs that was pretty damn good, right? I mean, Andy Philpott plays Dee, and he does an amazing job playing Dee. The Japanese voice actor was Hideyuki Tanaka, who also does an amazing job as Dee. Maya Link is played by John Rafter Lee. Again, does a superb job. Charlotte Elborn is played by Wendy Lee, who does a great job. Now, one of the things that I love about Vampire Hunter D is that it knows when to inject a little bit of comedy. It knows when to lighten the mood a little bit. And it also knows how to show the tragedy of Dee's entire existence. See, Dee is basically, he's not immortal like the vampires, but he is extremely long-lived. And in one of the scenes, there's this amazing bit with an old man at a stable. There's an amazing scene there where the old man tells these guys who were there to drive Dee out of town, he tells them a story about a Dunpeel hunter who saved 10 children of that town, right?
Yeah.
And you know where the story's going. You know how the story's going to end, but it's just done so bloody well. One of the other things that I just mentioned is how it lightens the mood. And one of the ways it does that is by using the voice talents of Mike McShane, who plays the role of Dee's left hand, which sounds dodgy, but I assure you it's not. Right? See, one of the genius things about this is that Dee has a parasite living in his left hand, a bit like Miggy from Parasite, living in what's-his-face's right hand.
Yeah.
And I think that Dee's left hand might have been an inspiration for Parasite. Because
would not surprise us.
Yeah, because Dee's left hand is sentient and also can swallow all sorts of things, especially forms of energy.
Mm-hmm.
This parasite is kind of like Dee's companion on his journey. And he's like an old wife. He nags Dee and he pesters him. And he pushes him, and he badges him, and he generally hounds him. And Dee just basically, he's pretty stoic about it all because he's heard all of it before thousands and thousands and thousands of times over the centuries. He's had his left hand nagging him about this or that or the other because if it wasn't nagging, it just wouldn't be his left hand. Which sounds really weird now that I actually say it out loud.
No, no, it makes sense. I say this has been out a long time.
Yeah, in the context of the film.
This was one of the ones that you used to have to go for, like this, Akira, Ninja Scrolls, them kind of ones.
You used to have to go through the original Vampire Hunter D, not this. People watch the original Vampire Hunter D and then make the comment, oh, it's not as good as I thought it was going to be. And they make the mistake of thinking the original Vampire Hunter D is the one that everybody wants them to watch. It's not. It's Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust that everyone wants you to watch.
Yeah.
The original Vampire Hunter D, it had style, it had substance, it had swagger. It was very, very good as a movie. But it hasn't held up that well. And that's the honest truth in terms of character design, in terms of production, in terms of animation, in terms of the aesthetic of it, in terms of all sorts of aspects of it. The original Vampire Hunter D has not held up as well as Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust. So when somebody says to you, you should watch Vampire Hunter D, what they're actually saying is, you should watch Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust because of the two Vampire Hunter D movies, it is the superior one, but not by much. It is marginal, and it's based on your personal preference. You might find that you are able to tolerate the original Vampire Hunter D and its aesthetic much better than the aesthetic of Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust. I like Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust a bit more because in the original, they tried to recreate the style, the character designs, and character style of Yoshitaka Amano and didn't do so well. Whereas in Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust, they've done extremely well at recreating Yoshitaka Amano's character style. So the story fits. The voice acting is great. The script is wonderful. It has some great bits of banter between D and his left hand. It has some great observations about the world and the characters that live within it. The world itself is a set place. You understand how the world works right from the beginning. And it doesn't need much world building at that point because you clearly defined the boundaries of the world. This place, this place, this place, and this place. That's it. You're not exploring any other parts of the world. You're not going to visit any other tribes or anything like that.
Yeah.
That is one of the best bits about Vampire Hunter D. There's an immediacy to the film, which you don't really get that often in this type of movie anymore. Not since bloody Twilight. So, Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust, I am highly recommending to anybody who likes vampires, likes cool anime movies, likes anime with swagger, because this has it in spades. D literally is a cool, and you can finish off the Samuel L. Jackson phrase yourself.
There's a lot of crossover in them fandoms. People love vampires, people love a cool aesthetic. Also, the fact he's called D might get a giggle off some of the immature ones.
Yeah, it will. One of the things I love about this is right at the end, the final line is basically D's left hand talking to him. It's just the two of them again. And that scene reminded me of, have you heard of a film called A Boy and His Dog?
No, I can't say I have.
It's a sci-fi film and I love the ending to it because the boy basically has the option of saving his dog or saving his girlfriend. Basically, his dog needs food to survive. His girlfriend needs food to survive. I'm not going to tell you which one he chose.
I'm assuming if it's a boy and his dog.
No, it's mainly him and his dog for most of the film, so I'm not going to tell you what he chooses. He may have gone foraging for food, you see?
All right.
I'm not going to tell you what's happened at the end of that. But the ending to Vampire Hunter D kind of reminded me of the ending of A Boy and His Dog, where you have two characters just wandering off into the sunset, wandering off into the horizon, and they're just swapping this banter. One of them's fairly stoic and noncommittal, and the other one's just trying to take the mickey as much as possible, which is basically D and his hand. And his hand's basically saying, you know, you're not such a bad guy. You know, I'll be honest, you've done some good things. It's just a shame about your dress sense.
Yeah, just like heartfelt banter, not like, Not mean or out.
Yeah, it's not mean or anything. He's just commenting on the fact that D wears a lot of black.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Like say, Vampire Hunter D, it was like that with Pat LaBore and Appleseed and whatnot. All them
from when I first got an anime ages ago. But like you say, Bloodlust, it's a different kettle of fish to what the original was.
Yeah, it is. Totally.
And it's the thing is, it's still going. I believe that like a Kickstarter. I don't know if it was last year, year before, but they had a Kickstarter for a comic book series. That's the last I heard of it. But it's one of them ones that if someone mentions it, it's like, oh, I remember that. Here's the nostalgia glasses on.
Yeah. Here's the thing. If you say, what are the best anime about vampires?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody at some point in there is going to say Helsing.
Yeah.
Somebody at some point in there is going to say...
Is it Dancing the Vampire Bun? Or
something like Seraph of the End. Somebody is absolutely going to say Vampire Knight. Somebody's going to say Bloodlad, which I do actually agree with Bloodlad. I think Bloodlad is a great vampire anime. Somebody's going to say Rosario and Vampire, because obviously it's got Vampire in the title. Diabolik Lovers, Dancing the Vampire Bund, Trinity Blood, Black Blood Brothers, Chibi Vampire.
There's quite a lot.
Strike the Blood, Sir Vamp, Tsukuyomi Moonphase, Vassalord, Nightwalker, Vampire Princess Miu, Fortune Arterial, even JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Yeah?
Aye.
Shingetsutan Tsukihime. Bakemonogatari. There's loads and loads of vampire anime. There's loads to choose from. But if I had to choose the ones that I would recommend you watch for vampires,
yeah,
I wouldn't choose Helsing Ultimate over Vampire Hunter D, Bloodlust. See, Helsing Ultimate is great and all. I'm not knocking it as a series. I think it's a great series. But Vampire Hunter D encapsulates something that Helsing Ultimate doesn't encapsulate. You know when you look at Dracula?
Yeah.
What do you think Dracula is? What kind of story is it?
Oh, I'd say if you go on like the old ones,
I'm talking about Bram Stoker's Dracula.
The Whitley Bear Dracula.
Not Whitley Bear. Whitby.
Whitby? I keep getting them mixed up.
It's not
Whitley Bear Dracula. Story, yeah.
Whitley Bear Dracula is a totally different.
Oh, God.
Can you imagine the Whitley Bear Dracula walks up to you and says, do you want a flake in that, love?
Got any monkey's blood? Well, got blood.
No, Bram Stoker's Dracula, the original Dracula, the one that gave birth to the whole idea of the modern vampire, blood sucking. Turning into bats, that sort of thing, yeah?
Yeah.
What sort of story do you think that is?
It's one of them things, because...
No, I mean, what type of story? Is it sci-fi? Is it fantasy? Is it drama?
Horror, like...
Yeah, you think it's horror, yeah?
Well, they say it's horror, but it's like all camp, like horror.
I disagree.
Would you?
Yeah, I know exactly what type of story Dracula is. At its heart, Dracula is above everything else, above the horror, above the drama, above the thriller. Dracula is a love story.
I can kind of say that.
There is no kind of. The reason why he turned his back on God was because he was fighting for his religion. He was fighting for his faith. But when he came home, he found that God hadn't protected his wife. And so he turned his back on God because God, he felt, had turned his back on him. And he swore he would continue living until he met his wife again.
Ooh, reminds us Castlevania season 2.
do you see what I mean? It's a love story, and that's why when in Bram Stoker's Dracula, when he meets what's her name? I've forgotten her name now. When he meets her, though, he sees the reincarnation of his wife, and he immediately falls in love again, and that's why he takes her away, and that's why she's also attracted to him.
But the mob with the pitchforks and torches aren't.
Well, it's not. It's Jonathan Harker who basically is the problem child. He's the fly in the ointment in that happy romance there, that happy unholy romance. But Vampire Hunter D: Bloodlust captures a little bit that style, a little bit that love story essence. When you mix that with what is kind of Yoshitaka Amano's artwork, you have a very, very unique approach to a vampire story. And I think that trumps the kind of cool gore horror of Helsing and Helsing Ultimate. So, yeah, I'd say Vampire Hunter D, Bloodlust. I'd say definitely Blood Plus.
Hmm?
Comedically and aesthetically, Bloodlad has a lot to offer in terms of a different way of looking at vampires. And finally, I'd say around the same level as Helsing, Helsing Ultimate, I'd say Shiki.
Yeah.
And I'd say if you're going to watch vampire anime, watch those ones first. So right at the top, I'd say before you watch any other vampire anime, watch Vampire Hunter D and Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust, and then watch the rest. And I'd say possibly leave Shiki until the end, even, because Shiki asks a lot of questions that only Vampire Hunter D really asks, or rather, Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust really asks.
So you say this is on Blu-ray, is it?
Yeah, it's on Blu-ray, and it's out now as well, so it's also worth getting. Anyway, that's the end of the show. Yeah, it's the end of the show.
Some would say it.
We will leave you for this week. We'll be back next week with more animated goodness. You can find all of our shows and all of our other shows on the Geek Show Podcast Network, on our website, or on Apple Podcasts or Audioboom. Just look for The Geek Show or Keyframe or any of the other shows we do.
We've also got more on YouTube as well, don't we?
Yeah, we also have more on YouTube. So, that's it from us. I've been Rob.
And I've been Tubby.
And we'll see you all later.
Goodbye.